Welcome to the Bible Gumshoe Podcast. In today's episode, we're asking the question, is there any evidence for the Exodus? The Exodus. It's the paradigm of redemption in the Old Testament. It's the event to which all other events look for their shape and meaning. It gave Israel its existence as a people and defines who they are throughout history. Absolutely nothing outside of the life and ministry of Jesus of Nazareth compares to it. But did it really happen? And if it happened, did it happen as described in the pages of the Hebrew Scriptures? Well, you may not be surprised to learn that many critics of the Bible, archaeologists, and modern-day academics say no. In an article published in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, author Nir Hassan says that, and I quote, "Archaeology has not been able to find the patriarch Abraham or signs of his heirs. There is no evidence that the children of Israel ever went to Egypt or fled in the Exodus. No evidence has been found of ancient Hebrews in Egypt or of their subsequent passage through the Sinai. Few outside the observant community dispute that the scripture is not a reliable description." End quote. Scholars often speak of a historical kernel in the Bible stories, but generally they claim that no evidence exists for their historical reality. This idea has been promulgated and popularized in countless documentaries and books about the Bible and the Old Testament. Take, for example, Nova's documentary entitled The Bible's Buried Secrets.
The Abraham narrative is part of the first book of the Bible, Genesis, along with Noah and the flood and Adam and Eve. Though they convey a powerful message, to date, there is no archaeology or text outside of the Bible to corroborate them.
The farther back you go in the biblical text, the more difficult it is to find historical material in it. The patriarchs go back to Genesis. Genesis is, for the most part, a compilation of myths, creation stories, things like that. And to find a historical core there is very difficult.
This absence of historical evidence leads scholars to take a different approach to reading the biblical narrative. They look beyond our modern notion of fact or fiction to ask why the Bible was written in the first place.
There is no word for history in the Hebrew Bible. The biblical writers were telling stories. They were good historians, and they could tell it the way it was when they wanted to, but their objective was always something far beyond that.
So what was their objective? To find out, scholars must uncover who wrote the Bible and when.
These professionally produced documentaries and the rolling out of innumerable scholars talking in that academic, "I'm in the know" kind of tone might lead the average viewer to believe that, in fact, there isn't any evidence whatsoever for the historical reality of any of the stories in the Bible. But is that really so? Well, if you want to know more, keep listening to this episode of the Bible Gumshoe Podcast. The Exodus. Is there any evidence? Egyptologist James Hofmeyer laments that the question of the biblical account of the Exodus is of little interest to most Egyptologists today, and the vast majority of critical biblical scholarship rejects it altogether. These scholars are known as historical minimalists. They read the Bible stories as containing nothing more than a historical nucleus or kernel of truth, if any truth at all can be found. Among the minimalists are scholars who dismiss the Exodus as a fanciful myth with no basis in archaeology or history whatsoever. Others are slightly more charitable and circumspect when it comes to the biblical narrative. The Egyptologist Donald Redford, for example, professor of classics and ancient Mediterranean studies at Pennsylvania State University, thinks that the stories of the Exodus and the sojourn in the wilderness are much later constructions, not historical accounts. He claims that there is no evidence for any significant population of what he calls Asiatics dwelling as a self-aware people group in the New Kingdom period of Egypt. In other words, according to Redford, there is no evidence for Israel ever being in Egypt at the time of the Exodus. His sentiments are echoed by many others, James Weinstein among them, who argued that Israel in Canaan in the 12th century shows, quote, hardly any evidence of Egyptian contact, end quote, which one would have expected from a people who had only recently departed from Egypt in the way that the Bible describes. Abraham Melmot disagrees with Weinstein and believes he sees evidence of Asiatics, people of Canaanite origin is what they mean, leaving Egypt at the beginning of the 12th century. But not as the Bible describes. These people are kicked out of Egypt by Pharaoh Setnakht. As one can see, it makes little difference whether the historicity of the Bible is denied outright, turned into mythology, or moved into a later century under different circumstances. The outcome is the same. The historical reality of the biblical narrative is rejected. Now, Christians continue to debate amongst themselves the fine historical details and the precise dating of Israel's stage-left exit from bondage in Egypt, but these debates remain largely intramural as long as historical minimalists continue to dominate the conversation in the public square, claiming that periods described in the Bible, like the Exodus, the sojourn, the conquest, and the Judges, never existed, or represent a mere theological and literary creation. And that's not to say that the stories of the Bible are meant to be mere history. No, in fact, they do have a theological purpose. But it's a theological purpose wrapped around a historical reality. Nevertheless, Weinstein's right when he says that the only question that matters is whether any extra-biblical evidence exists, whether textual or archaeological, to support an exodus, or what he calls a major overflow, of people from Egypt during the 19th and 20th dynasties. Sadly, he answers this question in the negative. But there is more than one way to evaluate the evidence, and not all scholars agree with his minimalist conclusions. Nevertheless, the question he asks is the right question, and arguably, maybe the most important one. So then, let's take up Weinstein's question. What extra-biblical evidence is there that the Hebrews were in Egypt and departed like the biblical narrative claims? Well, we can answer this question in two different ways. First, we'll look at a handful of common objections raised by historical minimalists who call into question the historical reliability of the biblical narrative. Then, we'll offer positive archaeological and textual evidence that supports the reality of the biblical story. In today's episode, we're only looking at these objections and potential answers to them. In the next episodes, we'll look at that positive archaeological evidence. And at this juncture, I should say that the question of historical reliability shouldn't be confused with the Christian doctrine of biblical inerrancy. The debate among Christian scholars over the precise dating of the Exodus often involved an a priori assumption that to reject a literal reading of 1 Kings 6 and Judges 11, 26-27 compromises the integrity of the Bible or weakens the doctrine of inerrancy. This is an argument set forth by Douglas Petrovich, who says that historical accuracy has been the major issue in attacks on the inerrancy of the Bible, and that a rejection of the 15th century date for the Exodus is an attack on biblical inerrancy that necessitates a, what he calls a, reasoned defense of the Bible's historical accuracy. Now, Petrovich isn't alone in allowing an a priori commitment to biblical inerrancy to decide the question on the dating of the Exodus. Bryant Wood calls the 15th century date the biblical model and the biblical date, quote unquote. Petrovich even goes so far as to argue that based on Israel's lunar calendar, which, he claims, God established for them, one could calculate the exact day, month, and year of the Exodus, taking into account, of course, Joshua's long day in Joshua 10:13, and the reversed shadow of 2 Kings 20:10. In doing this, Petrovich dates the Exodus, in his words, with relative confidence, to April 25th, 1446 BC. Now, the danger in misplaced a priori commitments is a loss of credibility in the public square. The problem is that a priori commitments of this kind keep scholars from fairly evaluating alternative evidence. And I'm not arguing for neutrality. There is no neutrality, just as there are no cold, hard facts. We all have biases and we interpret the world around us based on them. Facts are not self-authenticating. They have to be interpreted. What I'm arguing is that our one major a priori commitment here must be to seek for truth. We also need to be honest with ourselves about our presuppositions. Christian scholars can't ignore their pre-commitment to the truthfulness of the scriptures, to a supernatural worldview, to the historical reality of our sacred texts. However, that need not prevent us from being intellectually honest if we're able to be self-aware about how our presuppositions influence our thinking. Christians are not the only people subject to these pitfalls. Historical minimalists, whether religious or secularists, can be just as guilty and are of fallacious a priori reasoning as Christians, like those I've just cited here, often are. So we need to be careful about that. We're seeking for truth, and the question of the dating of the Exodus happens to be an important issue in evaluating all of the evidence surrounding the Exodus. Based on my evaluation of the evidence, I opt for a 13th century date, and I think that date actually allows us, in the evaluation of the Exodus, to better establish historical evidence for the event. But now, let's return to the objections and deal with a few of them. The first objection that gets raised is why the Egyptians make no mention whatsoever of a Hebrew exodus from Egypt. The second objection is that the number of Hebrews reported in the Bible to have left Egypt are unsubstantiated by the archaeological record. And finally, there's the objection that there is no archaeological evidence that the Hebrews were ever in the Northeast Delta region of Egypt. These objections are important because to argue for an exodus, one must establish that the Hebrews were actually there to begin with. Now, minimal scholars such as Shipper, Israel Finkelstein, Norma Franklin, Barbara Sivertson, and others have made their arguments based on the assumption that they weren't there and raised these and other objections to the reliability of the biblical narrative. So, let's start with that first objection. No honorable mention for the Israelites in the Egyptian chronology. Now, it's perfectly true that the Hebrew exodus from Egypt is nowhere mentioned in the annals of the Egyptians, not in the 13th and subsequent centuries, nor in the 15th century and onward if one were to assume an early date for the exodus. There's simply no literary confirmation in Egyptian records that the Exodus ever happened. This is perhaps, however, the easiest objection to dispense with. The reason that the Exodus events aren't mentioned by the Egyptians is because the Egyptians never recorded embarrassing events. They didn't record their losses, their stalemates, or their failures. The job of the royal scribe wasn't to record objective history. His job was to make the Pharaoh look good. Even when Pharaoh lost, he won. Kenneth Kitchen observes that the pharaohs would never monumentalize defeats, and that in fact, one who searches for documentary evidence of a bunch of slaves escaping from Egypt is likely to search for such evidence that cannot exist. This was common among ancient peoples anyway at the time. Chroniclers would often omit unfavorable reports or information, change the facts, or exaggerate victories in order to cast their sovereigns in the best possible light. Now, there's another reason why Egyptian documentary evidence of the Exodus is unlikely to exist. The geographical area to which the scholar investigating the Exodus account is confined is the northeast delta region of the Nile, an area which is described as an alluvia fan of mud deposited by the annual flooding of the Nile. The climate is inhospitable to the long-term survival of the kind of documents that might tell us details about the administrative life of the inhabitants of the 13th century, or before. These documents would have been written primarily on papyri. Papyrus was a highly unstable material made from reeds, an abundant source for the ancient paper from this very region, but not a material that is likely to have survived millennia. At the time, papyri would have been the material of choice to record administrative events or personal or local thoughts. The few papyri that have survived down to our day actually come from the desert climate at Memphis, not the northeast delta of the Nile. Only the pharaoh's great feats were ever memorialized in the stone and monumental structures, which spoke of battles, conquests, acquisitions, and the like. Never defeats or events that would have brought shame upon the pharaoh or the nation. Even minimalist scholars admit that this is the case. Barbara Sivertson concedes that archaeological inquiry into Egypt goes back only 150 years, and only in the middle and southern reaches of the Nile where the climate is arid and dry, but only recently in the northeast delta where there's nothing but mud and water, allowing little to survive even of the monuments. It wasn't until relatively recently, in the 1970s, that Manfred Bietig attempted to excavate an area north of the Wadi Tumilat, and at great pains discovered the ancient Hyksos city of Avaris at Tel El Daba. To add to this, the northeast delta has actually been sinking throughout history. This province, which would have been one of the most fertile parts of Egypt in ancient times, is actually now below sea level. The earliest evidence of settlements along the coast date from Persian times, 5th or 6th centuries. Nothing at all survives from 16th through the 2nd centuries BCE. This has gone well beneath the water or mud, or lost to posterity due to erosion and decomposition. So given this reality of the geographical setting of the Exodus, it's a wonder why scholars like Ronald Gobi and others demand what is impossible for the ground to actually yield up. Asking even for independent confirmation from the Egyptians, which they never would have given in the first place. Well, this episode has run a little long, so we'll wrap it up here. In the next episode, we'll deal with that second big objection. In other words, what do we make of all those big numbers of Hebrews leaving Egypt? Is there any evidence for that? Thank you for listening to the Bible Gumshoe Podcast as we've been talking about what evidence is there for the Exodus. If you want to hear more on this topic, stay tuned to the next few episodes. And until then, as Paul says to Timothy, do your best to present yourself as one approved to God, a worker who has no need to be ashamed, rightly handling the word of truth.